Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 64, section 5, which is old single column, page 722. Okay, the suddenly is finally upon us. We've been building up. You know, in the first part of this paper, through focusing specifically on the human evolution, and rather than the physical evolution, like we did before with the going through the Ice Age, but parallel with the Ice Age, we've been going through the Andonites, going forward from Andon and Fonta, and got into the primary issue that they focused on of the Neanderthal race, which recall I pointed out that's not what in general current scientists are calling the Neanderthals. We're about to get to that. That enters into the story here a little bit later on. Once we have the Sangiks in play, and I'll explain that when we get to it. But they had the foundation for what current scientists call the Neanderthals that they introduced. It started clear back 850,000 years ago and spread all over. And recall basically where we left the story prior to the origin of the colored races here. Even though the Neanderthals had their beginning in a distinct distillation of some of the better Andonite stock. And for a while, things were looking quite hopeful for the life carriers, that their experiment wasn't going to fail on them. It's at this point in the story looking a bit grim. The backmating, you know, has begun to creep into this situation again, and the human stock is getting very, very thin and minimal. So they're, they're kind of holding their breath, the life carriers, about whether or not this is going to come through. So you can imagine that they are literally jumping for joy here shortly when we get another italicized suddenly word coming into the story. One of those phase changes. Now, and as I was just pointing out, it couldn't have come at a better time. Just when it was needed, coincidentally, quote unquote, right? The whole finds a way. Right? It's events like this that would definitely reinforce how celestials trust the integrity of the whole. There's a lesson there for all of us, that whenever it's looking really grim and we're thinking we all need to start running around with our hair on fire and trying to micromanage everything because it's all going to fall apart unless, one of us saves everything, remember that there's an integrity in the whole. And the whole cannot fall. Parts ebb and flow, yes, but the whole marches steadily forward, never one tiny bit backward. It just moves steadily forward and coordinates the parts in all sorts of unexpected ways toward the grand universe being settled in light and life. And occasionally it does that in quite startling unusual fashion, as we're about to see here. So let's just let's start reading, and we'll see what they have for us here.
500,000 years ago, the Badanon tribes of the northwestern highlands of India became involved in another great racial struggle. For more than 100 years, this relentless warfare raged. And when the long fight was finished, only about 100 families were left. But these survivors were the most intelligent and desirable of all the then living descendants of Andon and Fanta.
Okay, so it seems like the story is repeating itself. You know, recall with the Badanon tribes. Well, we saw this back there, as I just mentioned, 850,000 years ago. That's what gave rise to that, you know, what the Revelatures were calling the Neanderthal race, was one of these very severe, okay, there's a lot of subhuman, you know, or very low quality creatures all around us here. Let's just start exterminating in ever widening circles, you know, until we've got it cleaned up as far as the eye can see again. So the same tribe going into the same mode as they did before, just that in itself would have produced an ongoing integrity in the Andonites that would have been very, very advantageous for the human stock. But that's just half of the story. What happens now in that context is very new and exciting. So you can see when they, you know, they're bringing them up. You know, we're in the same place, the northwestern highlands of India, just like before. It gets down to a very tiny group, right? You know, where you just have about 100 families, as they're saying. There's just a handful, you know, relative handful of individuals left that are the core integrous genetic stock. Okay, and very, very fortunately, you know, we saw this wasn't always the case. A lot of times, the best stock was getting killed off for various reasons, either warfare or, remember, they were getting into the whole human sacrifice thing, and you know, the more afraid they were, the more they think they needed to do something dramatic. You know, the better genetic stock they picked to sacrifice, and so it was looking very grim as they were killing off the best of them in various ways. But we had this core group still that had stayed in the, you know, near the origin point, that could consolidate itself again. Okay, so now what happens?
And now, among these highland Badanites, there was a new and strange occurrence. A man and woman living in the northeastern part of the then inhabited highland region began suddenly to produce a family of unusually intelligent children. This was the Sangik family, the ancestors of all of the six colored races of Urantia.
Okay, so note that unlike, you know, if you go back and look there in the block about 850,000 years ago, when you have, you know, italicized the Neanderthal race, there's no italicized suddenly there, right? I mean, that was just like the precursor here, just getting the cream of the crop separated from any sort of inferior genetics. But now we get a genuine suddenly. So you are literally having a vertical jump here in quality. See, unusually intelligent children. You know, that should kind of remind you of, you know, what they said about, for instance, Anna and Infanta, right? Or even before that, you know, some of those suddenlies. And as we were trying to get what they're talking about here in parallel to what humans, the terms that humans use for the fossils they find. Remember, you basically, with the original Andonites, you're talking about Homo erectus. You know, and the fact that we find a lot of Homo erectus that are very robust and primitive looking, that's appropriate because there's all kinds of back mating, right? And it's going to be hard to find a, you know, a very unback mated fossil example of the Andonites. But, you know, technically it's Homo erectus with all of the complexity and diversity of quote-unquote Homo erectus. And then we had what's appropriately called Homo neanderthalensis. So that redistilled and clarified Andonic stock, you know, worthy of being given a new designation scientifically because that new stock multiplied and spread all over the place. Now, remember, we had one other little interesting tidbit that that got in play. That remember, I pointed out in passing. They mentioned the Heidelberg race, you know, or what scientists call Homo heidelbergensis. And it didn't tell exactly when. Remember, but I pointed out it may have been a little bit of a parallel. Suddenly, just it was my speculation to what just happened here. You know, because remember, they made a point of saying you had two, you know, early on you had two integrous groups of Andonites. You know, the Badonin tribes and the Foxhall peoples. You know, so that you had, you know, way up there in Northern Europe a group, and then the ones here near the homeland. And it was obvious that this kind of level of integrity didn't last there, you know, in Europe. But there appeared to be, perhaps right, you know, around the same time there, the whole system, remember, is being is evolving, and it's evolving as a system, as a whole. There is this phase change in the system, you know, and it's very likely that phase change had a slight manifestation there in Europe to give you Homo heidelbergensis as well. It would have been a suddenly, but it started much lower, so it didn't go as high. Okay, and it ended up kind of being, because things had gotten down so low there with all those you know, near-human species coming up from Africa, you know, that we've found lots of fossils of, you know, it you kind of ended up in many ways with just sort of a relatively improved Homo erectus and an Andonic stock. But here, as you can tell, you have solid, integrous Andonites, so that when there's this suddenly, you don't just have new and improved Andonites anymore. You've got something very definitively better. And this is where you should first use the scientific term Homo sapiens. With the Sangix, you now have Homo sapiens. You know, the species name there, sapiens, and kind of a basic way, you know, it indicates intelligent, like they're saying here, unusually intelligent children. But it's usually, you know, you want to stress the higher quality, and, you know, and so it basically means wisdom. And think about, you're looking for humans that finally are utilizing the seventh adjutant in a significant enough way that they're civilizable, right? None of these humans have really been fundamentally civilizable. They've had society, they've had a very rudimentary culture that tended to fade real quick. You know, Anagar would kind of get a culture going, but it was, you know, it was hard to maintain it. And so it kind of just became a rudimentary society again, and but not fundamentally civilizable, because there just wasn't enough fullness of functioning of the seventh adjutant, and hence a relationship to the encirclement and the Holy Spirit, and hence a more personal phenomenon, to fundamentally get that fundamentally chosen personal fact of civilization in play. But you've got that now. You've got wise humans. You have Homo sapiens. All right, so that's the Sangiks. And we should just mention as an aside, they've coined a term here, Sangik. And it's an interesting term. You know, you probably recognize the root, of course, because it's a pretty commonly used Latin, you know, root, you know. You know, that's, you know, related to blood, right, in Latin. What the term literally means is bloodline producing. That IK suffix, this is the fun part of it. You know, remember, they're basically coining English-like words, you know, and so they're going to the Latin, they're, you know, occasionally the Greek, some Northern European, you know, they're going to the roots of Andite tongue, Indo-European tongue, and in general, they're sticking, right, to the Western part, the European part of Indo-European. Here's an exception. They couldn't resist to bring in a little Sanskrit, Indo-European, Andite root. Because of where are they? Northwestern highlands of India. They couldn't resist. That IK suffix is the agentive suffix in old Sanskrit. You know, it's like our ER suffix, you know, for instance. You know, that agent that produces, you know, in some specific mode. You know, if like rolling needs to be done, there's the roller, right? You know, I mean, that agent, right? It's the agentive suffix in Sanskrit. See, so it's producing. It's bloodline producing is what it literally means, because now we have the definitive origins of, you know, our whole concept of bloodlines in mankind, right? With the Sangic races. Yeah, and they're going to blend, and there's going to be a multiplicity of bloodlines of various mixtures and whatnot. But see, this is the origin of that fundamental bloodline phenomenon. All right, so that's why they coined it that way. Okay, so we have Homo sapiens, finally. The life carriers would not only are they... Whew, okay, we dodged a bullet on that one. Our experiment worked. took 500,000 years, and it was lots of twists and turns. Okay, but it came through. The focalizing action of God the Mother finally found a way to coalesce. You know, bring things to that coalescence point where it could suddenly go up. It was a long, circuitous process, but she finally found the means, right, to go up, and up it went. As our final big suddenly here. All right, and we'll get into the details here in a second with the next paragraph, but this whole bit about new and strange occurrences, as they mention here. You see something, though, in common to what we've seen a number of times. You know, this is one man, one woman, just like it's happened so many times. We have this pair phenomenon again. So, you know, it when the agent of the whole, right, when the individuality of the whole, right, finds that means... it's very focused, you know, and very economical. You know, if you can do it with two humans, why do it with more, right? And we just see it over and over again, right? That it really, you know, so again, we have a truth to the biblical Adam and Eve sort of a story, you know? I mean, you know, here's an example of all the bloodlines that we have. You know, you can take them all back to one man and one woman. Now, the other little aside, We'll see in a little bit. Remember, we also have this re-solidified Andonic stock, too. Besides getting the Sangiks, we've got the Andonites, reconsecrated, you might say. Okay. All right, so let's read the next paragraph here.
These Sangik children, 19 in number, were not only intelligent above their fellows, but their skins manifested a unique tendency to turn various colors upon exposure to sunlight. Among these 19 children were 5 red, 2 orange, 4 yellow, 2 green, 4 blue, and 2 indigo. These colors became more pronounced as the children grew older, and when these youths later mated with their fellow tribesmen, all of their offspring tended toward the skin color of the Sangik parent.
Okay, so before I talk about the specifics of Sangiks, just the last thing I was saying about, remembering how we have this as solid as you can get it still, Andonic stock. And they immediately are getting blended in. You aren't having these Sangik children just mating amongst themselves. Right? They're immediately mating with the Andonites. The dominance of the Sangik genetics is taking over the situation. So you're producing these Sangik tribes in many very different ways than they normally happen on a planet.
What did you mean when you said the Sangik situation was taking over?
Okay, you have a blue man, one of the blue children mating with just a plain, melanin skin tone, Andonite, right? And you get a blue child. Right, that skin color and some of the basic things that go with it, right, are dominant, over the a lot of the Andonic genetics. Right. Yep.
Do they discuss at all how people took to the idea of colored kids showing up? Didn't that surprise anybody?
Right. Well, it would have been. Obviously. But of course, remember we're dealing with very simple people, so and they have lots of superstitions and whatnot. So, they would have kind of just taken it all in stride, I suppose, in many ways. Remember they were sacrificing the best of them to try to make sure that the moon came back again. They're not thinking too sophisticated.
Okay.
I was just saying there, you've got, normally, right, you would have this, the red men on a planet just mating with themselves because there are no other humans. And Sangiks are high enough that there's no tendency to backmate. So, see, it would be very, very pure, quote unquote, right, in a normal world. Here, it's different. We don't, on this planet, we never had any of the races like a normal world has. They're fundamentally different, even before they start mating with the other Andonites, and they're definitely different after that. In that they that you produce these tribes of the different Sangiks by a blending phenomenon. Okay, obviously the life carriers knew that was going to be the case, one way or another. They didn't know exactly how the Sangiks would come about. They were surprised by this mode as well, that all in one family like this. Okay, but nonetheless, other than the details, that this was part of their plan to have a different type of Sangiks than on a normal world. Okay, now let's look at the details. Okay, so when they start tanning, right? When they get exposed to the sun and they start tanning, there's an additional pigment thing going on. Let's just get it, out of the way right up front. It's very, very difficult to find the definitive colors we're talking about here now.
That's what I was wondering.
You need to very much appreciate that when we're talking, like, say, indigo, you know, we're not saying, well, let's kind of pretend that it's indigo, or let's pretend that it's green. No, we're talking definitively indigo, right? Definitively green, right? Not black, and if I squint just right, you know, I can imagine it's a color and it's not black or dark brown. No, we're talking colors. You know, like, if you expose me to sunlight, carefully so I don't burn, but you do it carefully long enough, and my skin turns color like this, red. Right? I don't tan brown. I tan red. I mean, what little pigment I have is very much like this red man pigment. Right? When I've only done it once on any, you know, beyond just my face and stuff getting tanning, you know, and it is definitively red.
Right? Yeah,
me too. I mean, when someone looks at it, you know, when someone looked at it, they go, "Oh my God, you're burned!"
Yeah,
you know, so, no, I'm not burned at all. I wasn't burned at all, right? All right, so, and we'll see where that comes as they tell the story a little bit about Northern Europeans, but, yep.
No, I was raising my hand that I also turn red.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, so it's...
You were embarrassed.
Right, so...
How blue or green or yellow, like, close to these colors?
Well, no, I mean, it's always going, remember, see, this is the other thing. It's always on the foundation. They're all basically andonites as well, right? So, you know, and scientists know we all have this one skin pigment, right? Right, so there's always going to be that foundation, you know, underneath. I mean, the only way you can start to see, like, definitive red, like I was pointing to myself, is you've got to wash out, like a Northern European has that basic foundational brownness washed out almost completely, and then maybe you can start to see the colors on the white background. But here you don't have the colors on a white background, right? They're on that, go back, remind yourself what they described. Let's see if you go back. Let's see, where is that? That's, right here in beginning of section 4 in the previous paper, where it says, primitive man, the Andonites, had black eyes and a swarthy complexion, right? Something of a cross between yellow and red. Melanin is a coloring substance which is found in the skins of all human beings, right? Because all these Sangiks came from that. So... See, you know, you're left wondering, it's like, well, what's it like on a normal planet? You know, where, you know, the red would be different. You know, it isn't red built upon swarthy. It's just red. You know, I don't know. You can only guess.
Anybody ever wonder why there isn't violet? I mean, Roy G. Biv.
Right, so we can bring that up. So, in a little bit, as we start going through the separate races, we'll see why it's 6 and not 7. But just foreshadowing, you know, there's got to be a 7th. So obviously, there's a shoe yet to drop. Right? There's always the Adamites on every world. There's always another race. There's always a 7th race. Right? Now, of course, there, violet is not referring to a skin color. So you never had violet skin color. The violet thing is because of the glowing, you know. But here we're talking about definitively skin color, and it's all going to be on that swarthy, like I just went back and read for you, foundation. So they're all going to be darker. You know, and the primary Sangiks, red, yellow, blue, are going to be that basic Mongoloid-like type, not as dark, whereas the orange, green, indigo, the basic Negroid type, they're going to be darker, you know, because again, it's like primary colors and secondary colors, right? So, right. So the secondary ones are going to be fundamentally darker than the primary ones, As if you mix the three primaries, you're going to get brown man. And if you mix the three secondaries, you're going to get very, very dark brown man. You're going to get black man. And, that kind of takes you back. Remember what I was just reading. You know, see, fundamentally, you have a black starting point. Okay. So you can see how you, when you blend the three secondaries, you're pushing to something that is kind of hearkening back to that pre-blended andonic stock. Yeah.
Way back when I was working with group kids, mm-hmm. We did a little experiment where we put the various colors together. You know, we got as close to the colors that we thought that they were referring to as we could, and we were using watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
And then we drew them out with, more water and started blending them, and shazam, you just happen to get skin colors that you see all over the place today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it nails the skin colors when you start pulling those colors together and blending them at all.
Right.
It was really fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But watercolors are a good way to play with that.
Let's do that as a project
together. So we'll talk a little bit more about this, you know, exactly how to think about the colors as we get into each of them separately in the next section. But let's just deal with some of these main things up front. The biggie that jumps out is, you've got 5 red, 2 orange, 4 yellow, 2 green, 4 blue, 2 indigo. Okay, notice you have just 2 of each of the secondaries. 2 orange, 2 green, 2 indigo. So just in the numbers of kids that they produced, you see how innate the primary-secondary differential is, you know, that it literally manifests numerically,
right?
Where you basically have 4 primaries and 2 secondaries, with one exception, again, the spear point, right? On a normal world, right, the first humans come out of a red, subhuman stock, where those red, free men become humans. Okay, and and all you have is red man to begin with. Right, that's the spear point. You see that spear point fact here that there's 5. I mean, I'll bet you. The first child was red, even, right? Very, very likely. Because again, remember, this isn't some magic thing. This is the manifestation of the whole, right? The system is within the whole, right? The relationship amongst the Sanghas is inherent in the whole that's giving rise to this phenomenon, okay? So these patterns are innate in the phenomenon. The naturalness, if you will, of the phenomenon, yep.
What's always puzzled me about this is we're talking about the genetics, are we not? The genetics determine what we see.
Yeah.
Okay. So somehow these 2 Andonite parents gave rise to children with not only different genetics than themselves, apparently.
Right. They did. Yeah.
But different from one another.
Yep.
Dramatically different.
Yep.
And it's like, I have no way to even begin to think about that.
Okay, I mean, for those in the webinar, again, he's just pondering the imponderable about how you can take just a pair of Andonites. I mean, yes, they are, amongst this new and improved stock, if you will, but how their limited genetics, I mean, they're just Andonites, they're not like multicolored creatures or something, and you're distilling out different colors out of them or something, right? I mean, they're just an Andonite, right? How do you get all of this diversity of definitively different genetics and this distinct upgrade? I mean, it's the same phenomenon as we've been reading about, right, as we've gone through the last 550 million years. It's a suddenly, right? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Right, the egg. It's just one day a chicken hatched out of that egg, but its parents weren't chickens. Right? I mean, if you think it's dramatic here, I mean, think about some of those suddenlies that we've gone through in the past. Right? I mean, the parents were just like very different. Right? And the children had this huge suddenly jump where all of that genetics was reworked in one step. Right? So, you know, this is, again, it reminds you of how holistic a phenomenon this is. There's something above the parts, right, that recognizes all of the different possible arrangements of the parts, you know, and in the wholeness of that influence rearranges the parts, right? I mean, you have all these molecular structures, right? They just get rearranged in one step.
Yep. What I take from that, the implication is that in that initial step where the DNA from two parents, I'm talking about today, any parents,
mm-hmm.
when they come together, the mother influence must be involved in that.
Yes, I mean, it's the more you study, the whole meiosis-mitosis phenomenon, right, the more you recognize how there's a subtle phenomenon. I mean, just what produces the diversity of children of any two human parents, right? I mean, every time, right, there's this new combination of genes, you know, from what's coming from the grandparents, right, that gets blended in to those grandchildren. And there's the mother influence is always there, right? I mean, when scientists look at those steps in the process, you know, they see nothing manipulating that step, so they assume it's just a purely accidental step. No, there are no accidents. Right? That's a controlled step. There's nothing coincidental about your genetics. Right? Because after all, an absolutely unique personality coincidentally synchronized with your genetics, not any old genetics. Right? But it's all a vast conspiracy of wholeness that's in play. Right? There are no accidents. Right? There is nothing that's random. It's all controlled.
That's okay? Why a thought adjuster can check out who you are before you're even born.
Again, you know, the actual system is marvelously cool, right? I mean, the fact that, you know, without micromanaging, you know, there aren't little tweezers in there manipulating those molecules to get your particular chromosomes. And it all just seems to happen with no hands touching it, right? It all just happens in the wholeness of the system. It's the way things shift. And, you know, remember, if you want to get really to the details, there's nothing random about exactly how this particular oxygen molecule is moving in front of me right now, rattling around, bouncing off of other ones. In the wholeness of the Supreme, that's a given. That right now in this room at this time, it bounces off that molecule just then and off that molecule just then. And, right? You know, and there's, you know, volume of gas is this big in front of me. There's 10 to the 23 of those molecules all rattling against each other at high speed. But there's nothing, there's no accidents there. You know, and yet there's not predestination either. But it's all part of a system. It's all as it should be. Right? In an evolutionary context, nonetheless, every moment is a divine dispensation. The location of every nitrogen molecule and every oxygen molecule in this room is a divine dispensation. They're just exactly at the correct speed and place that they need to be. Every automaton in the earth is exactly at the correct spot it should be right now at this location in space and time. So that 500 trillion years from now, something will be just right then and there. And think, you know, appreciate that.
And the one you can't stop worshiping.
Right. I mean,
what?
You know, how absurd, how not only absurd, how horrid it is to assume what Lucifer assumed, right? Mm-hmm. That this is all just accidental, you know, and quote unquote natural. No, there is, you know, what we call natural is the artificial of God the Mother. What we tend to call artificial is the artificial of God the Father. That interjection, you know, that interventionary thing, right? But there is no natural. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed in toto. Every automaton, every single fact, right, is personality-managed, right? Right? It's just that there's two managers, two parents, right? And one works in this very subtle, you know, intangible, holistic way, God the Mother. The other works in this very noticeable, whoa, where did that come from? You know, all of a sudden, you know, this cup just moved, right? Because there was a God the Father order to intervene in space and time and move that cup, right? But, you know, and I would jump back startled, you know, at this intervention. Well, I mean, everything that's going on with that cup now is personality managed, just as much as it seemingly to magically move by an invisible hand, right? Why aren't we as amazed by what God the Mother is doing with every single automaton? You know, as occasionally looking for, you know, God the Father-like intervention into my life. Right? There's nothing but intervention in your life from God the Mother. Every atom in your body is personality managed by her. Right? Everything is.
Doesn't mean you don't get sick.
Yeah, right? It doesn't mean that this isn't an evolutionary domain. Right? I mean, and just think about, you know, you can imagine, you know, someone managing something, you know, it's made perfect and your job is just to keep it that way. That's your managerial job, right? To not let anything fall off the shelf or whatever, right? But think about how clever you have to be to manage it in this evolutionary mode. Like I said, where you gotta have these things moving right now, because in another super universe, 500 trillion years from now, there has to be a certain synchrony between what's going on now here and then there. How do you have the wisdom to synchronize like that across space and time? Well, you can if you're the individuality of the whole.
Eh? There's a mind that does that.
There's a mind that does that, right? The universal mother is
unfathomable.
Right. You know, it's hard enough to just, you know, keep it just in the local universe and have the local mother, you know. But, you know, expand it to the, you know, all of finite phenomena, right? Including all the finite stuff that's going on in the outer space levels right now, right? All of that is wrapped within one mind. Right? All the details, every automaton in every galaxy, right? every photon, every, like I said, I mean, there's 10 to the 23 molecules between my hands here in front of my face. I mean, that's just like incomprehensible. And that's just a basketball-sized collection of molecules, right? 10 to the 23. Yeah. Anyway. So... You have the yes. You have the glory that is the individuality of the whole expressing itself here. Coincidentally, quote unquote, there's 5 red, 2 orange, 4 yellow, 2 green, 4 blue, and 2 indigo.
Prison instrument sometimes only have 3.
Right, and then on some planets like we read, you don't have secondaries, you just have primaries. It all depends on what they're doing. And not surprisingly, we have all of them here because, you know, we're sort of letting it all hang out here, right? This is like, you know, we're taking off all the constraints and just letting the experiment have as much, lateral potential as possible, right? Can rattle around all over laterally. All right, so, but you definitely see... You know, the dominant recessive, that there's some definitive dominance of the Sangic genetics over the the merely endonic genetics. And it's not just skin deep. Right? But remember, you now have six races where adjutant mind fundamentally attunes to them differently. The Sangic, a red man and a yellow man can't think alike. It's impossible. No matter how much they might squint and clench their fists, they can't rearrange their DNA, right, and be a different Sangic race, and hence have adjutant mind attuned to that DNA, like the other Sangic. They fundamentally think differently. They can't think the same.
The book talks about that a few places, and it's hard for us to really understand that because we're only in one place. I mean, it's hard for me to understand how a person of a different race thinks differently. Though they say spiritually they can be alike. But
a way that you can easily see that they fundamentally think differently is that they have a different language. Right? Why is... when you just had Andonites, you had one language. As soon as you have six Sangics, you have six new languages.
Well, when I mean think, I mean like one and one is still two type thing. I mean,
Yeah.
It's different.
Right. But, I mean, the main reason, the main difference is, as we're about to get to, is that that adjutant mind is attuned to these Sangics. There's six foundational adjutants. And one cherry on the top adjutant, the seventh adjutant. Right? Six matches with six. I mean, each of the Sangics has all seven adjutants. Remember, I was just pointing out they're called Homo sapiens because they've got the seventh adjutant functioning better than before. But each of them has a bias of mind. Each one of them favors one of the adjutants. Right? So they have all seven. But the whole way that mind interprets its experiences and stuff is colored. If you're an orange man, you favor the third adjutant. You put that foot forward first. And then everything else kind of has to be rationalized in to follow suit. Right? You lead with that functioning. If you're a red man, you lead with the sixth adjutant.
So when you get all blended, it's different. Right? I mean,
so you can see again the point of the Adam and Eve, if not the prince's staff before that, working on blending the Sangic races, so that you don't you need a symmetric mind for that mind to be able to go up very high, right? When it's football shaped instead of basketball shaped, it can't really go up. It's not very symmetric. The seventh adjutant, the energy of symmetry. Can only go so far with a fundamentally colored race. It can work on establishing a symmetry at a higher level, but down below it's still a football, and it can't be anything else. It's attuned to that bias down at the foundation. You blend them and you upstep them with Adam and Eve. Now you have a very symmetric starting point. And you can take that up as high as you want. You can think of lots of simple examples. Think of that going up I'm talking about is something spinning faster and faster. Right? If you're going to make something spin faster and faster, it needs to be very symmetric. Right? If it's football shaped and you try to spin it really fast, it's going to fly apart. Right? That's an easy way to understand why. It has to be very symmetric in order to go up. Let's see, what else should we say up front here? You can't underestimate just how fundamentally different they are, as we're just trying to stress. Keep that in mind. Because that's very difficult. In modern times, we've had this whole politically correct, notion drummed into our heads, that it literally is just skin deep. It's not. It's not just skin deep. They're so different, you can't even resurrect them in the same hall on the first Mansion World. Their minds are so fundamentally different, right? That the environment in which that mind can get reestablished, it has to be in a separate space, walled off, right? So there isn't any crosstalk from those other mindal environments where those other Sangic races are being resurrected. They're that different, right? It goes, the difference goes soul deep, right? Those souls are being resurrected on the Mansion Worlds. The souls are fundamental. It's that deep, right?
So with the amount of blending, we have quite a bit of blending already on this planet. So with all that blending, what do they do with us as far as
They resurrect us in the mixed race hall, right? But you know, the problem with our blending is there's no management. There was no management of it, basically. And so it's all very haphazard. You know, and instead of it being done with a wise eye so that you tend to have positive consequences, there's a lot of negative consequences of the blending. You know, there's the races are blended at cross purposes. You've got these cross currents. You know, instead of getting it so that the currents all kind of get lined up and going in the same direction, you got things flowing, you know, across currents in your mind. You know, your red man genetics is wanting to take you this way, and your blue man genetics is wanting to take you at right angles to that, and so you're just being torn apart inside. You know, and that obviously is even more hopeless to try to move upward. You know, something. Yeah. Right. So. All right, let's get that last little tidbit there.
And now I interrupt the chronological narrative after calling attention to the arrival of the planetary prince at about this time while we separately consider the six Sangic races of Urantia.
Okay, so just a one little tidbit before we do that, consider the six. Right, why is the planetary prince coming now? Right, what is the key thing that I was just stressing a little bit ago that happened? Right, they're Homo sapiens. They are civilizable now, because the prince and his staff come as the civilizational uplifters. Right, you can't uplift that which is not civilizable if you're the civilizational uplifter. Right, so prince and his staff had to wait until you had civilizable people, not just socializable, culturalizable, civilizable people. All right, so that's the key thing, but. You know, when we get done with all the evolutionary stuff, we'll get to the planetary prince and his staff. But meanwhile, back to the Sangic. So let's read a little bit here.
Six, the six Sangic races of Urantia. On an average evolutionary planet, the six evolutionary races of color appear one by one. The red man is the first to evolve, and for ages he roams the world before the seceding colored races make their appearance. The simultaneous emergence of all six races on Urantia and in one family was most unusual.
Okay, notice it's not singular, obviously, but it is most unusual. Yeah, and obviously they're stressing it's especially the all-in-one family thing. So apparently, you know, you got planets where you have something kind of similar where you get all six at the same time, or maybe subsets at the same time or something. But in all in one family, that's what's really relatively unique, apparently. And so it just again stresses, as I kept focusing on how, you know, it all began with just, you know, one male and one female. That's a very definitive, this bottleneck thing on this planet is, you know, it's appropriate that, you know, if that one frog had jumped a little bit shorter, you know, that's the whole story of our planet is the evolution went through very narrow little bottlenecks, right, and then fanned out again. It must be, I'm suspecting that they're trying to, you know, what they're trying to do. I'm sure they're not really surprised by that. It can only fundamentally happen when, in order to get it to go up, you can't just kind of distill it down to a kind of a smallish mass. It's got to literally be distilled all the way down to a pear in order to go up. You know, it's probably they're pushing the limits, right? If they loosen it any more, right? In order to try to get the focus point, you'd go to zero, and there wouldn't be anything to go up, right? I mean, they've made it so it has to actually focus to the minimum in order to go up. Oh, so they must have been pushing it to the very limits.
So they pushed everything on this planet to the limit.
Yeah, it appears that way. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And
they got the will. They definitely got the will, but they were, you know, they needed to get Sangix, right, too. Right? And so that's what I'm saying. It's like, oh, maybe we pushed it a little bit too far. Right? There, you know, maybe it literally goes to zero in trying to go up, and it's just not going to go up. You know, but, you know, it found a way. It was there.
More so in the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And unique.
Right. You know, they're trying to flesh out the full horizontal spectrum of the Supreme.
But it's more challenging.
And so you've got these greater differentials, you know, these higher voltages than you normally have. The inevitabilities can function here better than in most places, right? Because the contrast is greater. Right? Altruism can be greater here than in most places in the universe, for instance. Or happiness can be greater here than in most places in the universe. Yeah. If you choose. Yeah.
It's worth going through it here. But I was thinking too, our mansion hall is also a wild different thing. Like, what is that? Like, I had never thought of that. It's the first time I've heard anything about it.
It'll be quite an experience when we wake up, you know.
And that is
wild. The hodgepodge of of creatures that will be with us there. Wow. All right, they give you another little tidbit before they get to Red Man here.
The appearance of the earlier Andonites on your rancho was also something new in Satania. On no other world in the local system has such a race of will creatures evolved in advance of the evolutionary races of color.
So in terms of Satan, the life carriers hadn't pushed it this far. But you can tell again, I mean, obviously outside of our local system, there are other examples, right? But so it's not extremely rare, but relatively so, yes. Okay, let's get to the spear point here.
One, the red man. These peoples were remarkable specimens of the human race, in many ways superior to Andon and Fanta. They were a most intelligent group and were the first of the Sengic children to develop a tribal civilization and government. They were always monogamous. Even their mixed descendants seldom practiced plural mating.
In later times...
Oh, wait, no, before you read, let's get that first little paragraph there first. I wanted to especially stop there because, with the primary Sangix, and we won't belabor this, but it's very straightforward to see the favoritism of the particular adjutant with the primary Sangix, whether it's the fourth, fifth, or sixth adjutant. That whole fact of, like I was just saying a while ago, you have the basic social urge or social impulse with the fifth adjutant that's the predicate for rudimentary society. You bring in the sixth adjutant, you juice that up, and you can have a culture. With the seventh and choice and encirclement of the Holy Spirit, you can have civilization. Okay. You see, when they say that they were the first of the Sangic children to develop a tribal civilization. Okay. Again, that's because they're because of their favoritism of the sixth adjutant. Right, they're more than anyone else. They're pushing things beyond just the fifth adjutant energy of socialization. Right, and that spear point pushing things forward to through the sixth. To a human, more human expression. So I mean, it's their favoritism of the sixth that is why they are the first like that. And they have this, notice that they have a kind of a natural sense of purity, if you will, maybe, right? I mean, the unity consciousness that the religious impulse, the sixth adjutant gives you, right? You know, fosters things like they were always monogamous, right? Not that they had some high transcendent sense of true monogamy, but just, you know, think about what their tendencies, their instincts are. When humans are looking for purity in a very simple, immature way, they achieve it by simplicity, right? Plural mating, that's complicated, and things are going every which direction. It just doesn't feel pure if you can just get these two, you know, and just to synchronize and go along together, right? It felt proper to their sense of purity, their sense of unity, to do that. So it was just a natural tendency for them. It's the challenge is to not for us to recognize that. Is that fundamentally unity is not that poor man's unity of simplistic oneness. When we're primitive about our unity instinct, it's like, well, if we just kill everyone that doesn't think like us, then we'll have unity. See, you know, there's that tendency to think in that primitive mode. If we can just stop everyone that doesn't think like me from talking, then we'll have unity. It's like, see, well, no, technically, right, so you don't. You know, you have an individuality that's being exalted into a unity. But that's the immature initial tendency. You know, what's behind that? That desire for unity, you know, in the sixth adjutant. Okay. Now read the next one.
In later times, they had serious and prolonged trouble with their yellow brethren in Asia. They were aided by their early invention of the bow and arrow, but they had unfortunately inherited much of the tendency of their ancestors to fight among themselves. And this so weakened them that the yellow tribes were able to drive them off the Asiatic continent.
And we'll get to another, you know, basic reason why the yellow man could drive them off the continent when we... You know, when we talk about the yellow man here. But the big thing, notice up front, is they have a lot of zeal, right, because of the sixth adjutant, favoritism. So not surprisingly, all good things taken to extreme become bad. They can quickly become their own worst enemies, right, and have, you know, this strong tendency, you know, to fight amongst themselves. Again, you know, you're looking for this purity, and you start to get more and more minute about it. It's like, well, now that I think about it, you know, you're just a little bit different, and I detest that. You know, if I could just get rid of you, then, you know, we'd have purity. See, and it starts to become a really problematic thing, where they're just about killing themselves off. You know, in the desire for purity. That's part of the emergency why this book is in my lap, right? The greater spiritual consciousness now is producing that kind of a phenomenon where we're going to destroy ourselves in an attempt to find purity. You know, we've lost sight of e pluribus unum, right? Of going up to harmony. You know, and instead we're trying to just get down to some singular individuality which we can declare to be unity. You know, we're going down to it. You know, and we're destroying civilization. When everyone is exactly like you, ta-da, you're tolerant, and you satisfy your spiritual urge to be tolerance. Right? It's trivial for Havona natives to be tolerant. Right? The point is to not, you know, eliminate everyone that's different than you, so that you can deceive yourself in as being tolerant. Right? That's not tolerance. That's nothing.
Yeah, you're tolerant because there's no one to be intolerant of. All
right,
yeah.
Ta-da. All right.
Happy, would you rather be right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right all the time.
Right on.
See, notice that. See, the red man becomes the poster child for some of the problems that have led to the emergency on the planet. They brought us the fifth epical revelation. You know, you got to be, you need a bridle on your spiritual consciousness. Unbridled zeal quickly becomes self-destructive. Quickly. Because it's geometric.
So, Chris, you brought up the suddenly and the mother and everything. And you just mentioned what you mentioned almost every week about the revelation in your lap.
Yep.
Suddenly get out of your lap.
Well, I guess the reason why I often refer to it as a thing in my lap
is
it's just so incredible that there's a revelation in my lap. I mean, think about how amazing that is. Right?
Yeah. So it could be a suddenly, couldn't it?
It could be a suddenly.
But, okay.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we got the red man. We see his favoritism of the sixth agent has some positives, but it also has some negatives. And the longer he goes without being managed and blended in, the more problematic it becomes. Okay. Let's see what happens here.
About 85,000 years ago, the comparatively pure remnants of the red race went en masse across to North America. And shortly thereafter, the Bering Land isthmus sank, thus isolating them. No red man ever returned to Asia. But throughout Siberia, China, Central Asia, India, and Europe, they left much behind of their stock blended with the other colored races.
You get to the specifics in a little bit, but you can see a little hint at it there, that there is red man that made it to Europe, blended into Europe, so that I can end up having red pigment when I tan. And when they say things like, but throughout Siberia, in very short order with the Sangiks, the Andonites get shoved up to the northern margins. Right? And so when they mention that, that's some red man blending with Andonic stock up there in Siberia. And so when you go up to Siberia now, you can see these. It's like, they look a little bit like Amerinds. Right, it's because they left behind some red men there.
But you're living here where they were in North America, so that's why you have red in your skin.
Oh, that's what it is. The color of the skin is all about geography, so they say, yes. Right.
You were just saying, you can see how you could have got some isolated.
Yeah. But it actually is. It goes very deep into the Northern European stock. That is, I was making a joke there. I mean, for those of you who don't know, you know how wrapped around the axle we've gotten, and trying to close our eyes to the existence of races. We now have literally convinced ourselves that as you walk from the equator towards the North Pole, your skin gets lighter. and that's why, the northern peoples are of light skin and the people at the equator have dark skin. I mean, we literally have supposedly intelligent people that believe that. It's pretty ridiculous the way we are closing our eyes to facts. You have to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. And we're closing our eyes to facts. We got all kinds of idyllic desires. There's all kinds of spiritual consciousness. But the more we close our eyes to facts, the less wisdom there is, and civilization collapses.
Well, we have alternative facts.
There's always alternative facts. And the two sides love to, throw that back and forth at each other. Yes. Now, unfortunately, let me dwell on that for a second. Remember that's fundamentally what the revelation is trying to get us to recognize. That in all areas of thought, we need some alternative facts. The current so-called facts aren't facts. They're desires. Right? It's not a fact that your skin gets lighter as you walk from the equator to the North Pole. But there's a lot of people that believe that's a fact and create whole institutions predicated on that belief. Right, there's lots of so-called facts that aren't facts, And just the tendency to you know, to mock someone suggesting that there's alternative facts. See, is it? Remember, they're trying to suppress their reality response. They're trying to suppress their relationship to the Holy Spirit in order to believe the things that they believe, right? And when someone reminds them that they're deceiving themselves, right, you know, they lash out. This is part of the problem, right? We do need alternative facts and everything, because what we have is not fact, it's figment.
Yeah, but the alternative facts you're talking about are bull.
Right, but again...
Nothing but bull.
Right, but I know, but just, you know, I mean, forget about the specifics. The specifics are irrelevant, but there's a truth. See, there's a truth. See, and that's the challenge. Is, you know, notice that there's truth to be found in a lot of places. All the people that are arguing about these in stupid ways, there's no truth there to be found. But you can step aside from their argument that's meaningless and go, well, you know, there actually is a point there for me to recognize. We are in need, like fundamentally from the first paragraph of the book to the last sentence of the book, they're saying you need better ideas about God. There's certain things about God that you believe are facts. You could really use some alternative facts. Right, you could use some real facts. See, that's the thing about some alternative facts, quote unquote, are alternative figments.
Right.
So using
and so you have two people arguing about figment. Well, my figments are better than your figments, you know, but they both call them their figments facts. Yeah, but guess what? Just because everyone is dealing with figments and arguing about which one is fact doesn't mean there aren't facts.
Right. I get your point.
See, that's the challenge with the revelation, to actually get a factual interpretation of the revelation, not an apparently factual interpretation, which is actually figmentary. Right? It's just a mirror of your mind. Right? And it's, you're not actually seeing the facts of the revelation. You're seeing a reflection of your figmentary worldview, you know, bouncing off the page. It's very difficult, right? I mean, you can't distinguish a fact from a figment subjectively. They're identical subjectively, right? And it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch that take delight in cultivating the gift you've been given that can distinguish a fact from a figment, the first cosmic intuition, right? I mean, no wonder people argue about facts and alternative facts and whatnot. There's no objective consciousness on either side of the argument, even though they both think that they're thinking objectively, right? There's no objective consciousness on either side. Yeah? And so they're just approaching their fact, quote unquote, subjectively. Oh, I'm feeling it. It's solid. It's a fact. No, they're both hollow, guys. Neither of you have fact. Neither of you have fact. And that's a fact. Okay, it's a huge. The revelation is a huge challenge. You know, do you have the courage to erase all of your interpretations of every experience? Right? Do you trust God enough that you'll let go of yourself like that? That you're willing to erase your interpretation of all your experiences, including your spiritual experiences? You're willing to let them be potentially erroneous? Even wrong, like the relators say. Do you have the courage to erase your interpretations of your most cherished experiences and go at them anew? To not put new wine in old wineskins, right? In order to not put new wine in old wineskins, you have to be willing to erase all of the interpretations of your experiences. Those are old wineskins. Unless you believe that you're innately divine. And your wineskins, yeah, they may be old, but they're perfect. Like Lucifer told us, Caligastia told us, right? No, those interpretations are the old wineskins. Are you willing to erase them? Right? Every interpretation you've had of every, you know, experience, material, spiritual, whatever. And try them anew. Come at them anew. To try to get a new worldview from the revelation and reinterpret everything in that new worldview. And it's a holistic thing. You know, The worldview you have right now affects every interpretation. So, you know, to get rid of that old worldview, you have to get rid of every interpretation. It's every interpretation is bound to one worldview. You know, it's a huge thing. You have to have courage, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Right? And it's not for the timid souls who can only keep up the struggle of life by the aid of continuous false illusions of success. That you've successfully interpreted something. That you've successfully interpreted your most sublime spiritual experience. You're certain of it. Right? You can base your entire eternal career on that interpretation, right, of something that's living in a world that's the orgy of darkness and death. There couldn't be any issue with your worldview. And it must be perfect. I mean, yeah, think about how silly that is. Right? How far are you from being able to be led into Havona? Right? I mean, how impure are your worldview? Is your worldview right now? It's in need of great reformation. Do you have the courage to let go and start fresh? And leave things uninterpreted when you know it's best to just not interpret them right now, because you probably can't properly interpret them. So just let them be. Trust everything beyond the dead level of consciousness. Right, what does it say? Don't go interpreting where you don't need to be interpreting. Right? Religious speculation is always what? Very helpful. Does it say that in the Revelation? No, it doesn't say that. Right? Just leave it, let it be. You don't need to interpret everything.
Right? I don't know is okay.
Just let it be.
Yeah.
Let yourself be grown.
That was the name of a famous song.
Yeah, yes. I was just going to say that, John.
Speaking Beatles. Words of wisdom, yeah. Right? Let it be. That is a wise thought. Right? Let yourself be grown. Don't try to build yourself with all kinds of clever interpretations. Yeah.
Use the word independent.
Yeah.
And so that sounds like a lot of work to me.
Yeah. To get to the point where you're independently integrous and can properly interpret in and of your own objective mind. Wow. You know, you're probably still praying for help, right? Praying for wisdom, things like that. Right? I mean, imagine getting to the point where it's like, no, I don't need to pray for celestial help. I've got this. I've got the integrity. I don't need to ask for help. Oh, that seems like kind of presumptuous still. So yeah, you probably aren't ready yet, right? And you probably just shouldn't be interpreting a lot of things. Just let it be, right? But eventually you will get to the point where you know you got it. I mean, eventually you'll get to Uversa and the Ancients of Days, with their infinite microscopes, the universal sensors, know you've got it. And they hand a task over to you, knowing you've got it. Completely independently, you're all over it. It will be just so. Not one little black dot, you know, will enter in. It'll be devoid of even the minutest error, your actions.
And you're still humble.
Yeah, and you're humble. Right. You're sublimely humble. But you got it. Right? Because you've been grown into that integrity. You didn't presume it.
So to presume you got it today.
Yeah. Right. Like I said, I often bring up that capital J Judges handing something over to you thing. This is just a reminder. I mean, seriously, you can follow along with the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto to that degree that you think right now the Ancients of Days could hand you a task? Seriously? Right? Do you think you're innately divine? I mean, it's just how absurd that is. All right. Anyway, back to the colored races.
Ready?
Yeah, let's see. So was there anything we missed there? Remember the key date there of about 85,000 years ago. So it's relatively recent, but everyone knows that's there's relatively recent, and then there's relatively recent. I mean, you know, it's only just very recently, pardon the pun, that scientists are even allowing anything prior to Clovis Point culture, you know, prior to, say, 13,000 years ago. Right? Maybe you can get some of them to allow 20,000 years ago. I bet 85,000 years ago coming over to North America. Yeah. Even the most radical ones aren't pushing it that far yet. Maybe some of the radicals are pushing it to 50. But 85? That's really pushing it. And see, so we, you know, relative to current scientific thinking, we've been here a lot longer. And you have to wonder if the only reason they're allowed to give you that date like that is because we just can't figure that out anyway. That may be why we're so off right now. It's just not, we're never going to find evidence that validates that date. You have to just know that they've been here that long. That may be the case, you know, why they can tell you that. You know, it is about, okay, so they aren't giving you to 10 decimal places or something, right? They're not giving you the day they started walking across the Bering Strait. But still, you know, it's a relatively precise date.
Chris, I was thinking just one more thing. That isolation from the Bering Strait happening made it so our country could come into existence and be isolated like that.
Yeah, yeah, we all know that, you know, there's the interesting thing with all that geographic evolution we were reading about, you know, with the fracturing of the one continent and all that. Coincidentally, it ended up that there's this place that's relatively isolated where there could be a, you know, a little sanctuary for a while for the spear point of civilization to solidify. But now that's over and, you know, and civilization's in jeopardy because instead of maintaining the integrity that we were given, the geographic gift to solidify, we're letting go of that. Right? Yeah.
You were talking about using the word pure.
Pure, yeah. Comparatively pure remnants, yes. Yes. I was hoping you'd notice that. Yeah, yeah, just, yeah, see. Yeah, that's a little bit of a pun, see, that they're throwing in there. Yeah, because of who they're talking about, the red race. Okay, so, yeah, keep going here.
When the red man crossed over into America, he brought along much of the teachings and traditions of his early origin. His immediate ancestors had been in touch with the later activities of the world headquarters of the Planetary Prince. But in a short time after reaching the Americas, the red men began to lose sight of these teachings, and there occurred a great decline in intellectual and spiritual culture. Very soon, these people again fell to fighting so fiercely among themselves that it appeared that these tribal wars would result in the speedy extinction of this remnant of the comparatively pure red race.
Okay, so even though they're the spear point, even though they have this favoritism of the sixth adjutant genetically, they still need guidance. Right? There's a reason why Planetary Prince and his staff come to every world basically as soon as you have Sangix. You're seeing it right there. We all need parents. None of us are self-actualizing. Yeah, so without that guidance, again, the favoritism of the sixth adjutant, you know, kicks in and all good things taken to extreme become bad, and in very short order, they're on the verge of just literally exterminating themselves. Okay, yeah, keep going.
Because of this great retrogression, the red men seemed doomed when about 65,000 years ago, Anamalantan appeared as their leader and spiritual deliverer. He brought temporary peace among the American red men and revived their worship of the Great Spirit. Anamalantan lived to be 96 years of age and maintained his headquarters among the great redwood trees of California. Many of his later descendants have come down to modern times among the Blackfoot Indians.
One thing that leaps out there is, you know, 96. You know, notice that we, when we, they haven't given us any specifics on that, But in going from Neanderthals with, an average longevity of 75, maybe the average hasn't moved much, but the tail has definitely lengthened, it appears, to have individuals living pushing 100, that may have come along with the improvement in the genetics. Obviously, there's got to be some sheltering still for somebody to, actually achieve their longevity and not just be a victim of the environment and a low life expectancy. But you notice here again, it seemed, the appearance was that it was doomed, but it really wasn't. The difference between appearance and reality. No, it found a way, right, to coalesce it in an individual. Anuman Alantan appeared on the scene.
Is he known out in outside of the Rancho Book in culture?
No, he's not. And you can see, it's not too surprising, 65,000 years ago, that's a long time. That's, like I said, that's still a lot longer ago than even the most radical people are thinking there were people in North America. So it got lost in the mists. Again, you see, what name does he use, the Great Spirit? Again, that's the favoritism of the sixth adjutant. You take the way, your mind relates to reality, and you exalt that up to a God concept, right? And that's the differential in their mind. So it's the Great Spirit. They have a tendency to get kind of animistic and just kind of blur everything together all into a spiritual unity. The rocks have spirit, and everything has spirit. That's their tendency, to overemphasize the unity like that and lose the individuality.
So what you're saying is, when you see that or recognize that in individuals, it might be because of being partially redheaded, so to speak.
Yeah, plus there's just the fact that, exacerbated by the fact that we're two-brainers and not one or three-brainers, and just in the overarching all of the bloodline differentials and whatnot, sangic differentials and all that, overarching the whole big picture is there's kind of a tendency for 50% of the people to be biased to their individuality consciousness and 50% of the people to be biased to the unity consciousness, and that's why we end up in dichotomies on everything. We're arguing about, no, I'm right, no, I'm right, and it's just that basic bias of arguing across the hemispheres. Why do we have a Congress with a central aisle and there's the left and the right? It's just, it's because roughly 50% of the people are born favoring their unity consciousness, and that biases their whole way they think about things, and 50% are favoring their individuality consciousness, and both quickly get to thinking that one is right and the other's wrong or things like that. And, and it's, it's a very transcendent fact. You'll have, a parent that's very definitively favors their unity consciousness, and they're really thinking that their whole family going forward is going to be definitively in that tribe. And their son is born, and he completely favors his individuality consciousness and, doesn't want to think like dad at all. Right. See, again, because that is so overarching, that basic, it's basically in the mode of, you end up with about 50% females and 50% males. It's the same kind of overarching fact that transcends all the other minor issues.
Not a no-brainer. It's a two-brainer.
Yes, it's a two-brainer. And we all have to be humble about that. Figure out which bias you were born with, right? And, most likely if you're reading the Arantia book, you were born with a bias towards your unity consciousness. That's almost a given that you have any interest in reading something that mentions God. Just recognize that's your initial challenge. Okay, I'm biased to the unity consciousness side. If I have any hope of a more profound personality expression, I need to get some balance. I have to find a way to bring in more of my individuality consciousness. Because only when you can bring equal measure and equal measure together can you get a super additive consequence of some cosmic consciousness, right? And your personality is what it wraps around cosmic consciousness, the triunity of cosmic consciousness. Your personality can't wrap around unity consciousness or individuality consciousness. And, you know, if you want to really stress why, when you favor your unity consciousness to begin with, that you should be interested in individuality consciousness, remember what the Revelation says about your personality. It's absolutely individuated. Right? Fundamentally, if you don't have a definitive individuality in your mind, how could there be this absolutely individuated personality identified with it? Right? There has to be a definitive individuality. You know, you can't fuzz your individuality out, you know, beyond a certain degree, or just you can't avail yourself of your personal nature. It has no way to identify with such a fuzzed out fact. Right? It's not a collective phenomenon, your personality. It's an absolutely individuated phenomenon. And it needs, that's why all of us are made by God. So we start out, and one of our first words is, mine. We start out individuated so that there's a starting point for a personality to identify. And then it's just up to you to, you know, do something positive with that individuality instead of something negative. But individuality you must be to be personal.
So since you are saying that we would tend, since we're attracted to spirituality and God, and that we're going to tend to go to that side of unity, have a bias that way, would scientists be more individualistic then?
Yeah, I mean, someone who kind of just, you know, works with their individuality, their material consciousness better to start with, you know, they'll naturally gravitate to something that deals with all the parts, all the details of all the parts. You know, they're a scientist or, you know, various flavors. I mean, they don't have to be, you know, chemist or something. They can be an economist or, you know, or whatever. I mean, someone that can focus in on all the parts and wrap their mind around all the details of all the relationships amongst all the parts, and instead of, oh, I don't know, parts make my head hurt. I have to pretend there aren't any parts, and I have to just, you know, spread myself into the unity, and, you know, yeah. I can feel something, and
very good.
Just recognize what your first challenge is. You know, and if you start with favoring your individuality consciousness, okay, your first challenge, you got to bring in some unity consciousness, right? Or you're going to be hopelessly prosaic, right? You got to bring in some genuine inspiration of some unity consciousness and get some balance going. You know, and if you can't do it yourself, make a point of finding someone who is obviously born with on the other side of the genetic differential from you, and see if you can work together and help each other. I'll help you with your individuality consciousness if you help me with my unity consciousness. You know, and we can work it back and forth, and maybe we can start to be a little more balanced, like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams getting together and finding some balance, because one was born favoring his individuality consciousness, and the other was born favoring his unity consciousness. Right? And for years they were just, you know, hating each other as right and wrong. And finally they matured enough and they recognized, no, you're my other half. Yeah, I'm only half a human because of my bias. If I interact with you more intimately, I can find my wholeness. I can find my way up. Right? But now we demonize, you know, each other more and more and more. You know? You know, I hate you because you favor your individuality consciousness. It's horrid, you know. I mean, it's so self-destructive. You know, you need to recognize that you very much need that other person to have any hope of wholeness in your mind. Okay, let's keep going here.
As time passed, the teachings of Anumana Lantan became hazy traditions. Internecine wars were resumed, and never after the days of this great teacher did another leader succeed in bringing universal peace among them. Increasingly, the more intelligent strains perished in these tribal struggles. Otherwise, a great civilization would have been built upon the North American continent by these able and intelligent red men.
Yeah, see, so but for this tendency to kill each other off. And see, right there, I mean, it's not surprising that, you know, you can't look up in your kids, you know, famous Indian leaders book and find Anamanalantan. Yeah, he became a hazer tradition.
That's because his name was so long.
and remember how, you know, a great example of someone trying to do what Anamanalantan did was Tenskwatawa. You know, and then the revelation even validates he was a genuine prophet. But he couldn't do it. You know, even he tried and tried, and, you know, couldn't do it. They're just the intensity, the tribal zeal is just too intense when they favor their sixth adjutant that much. You can't, they just could not subjugate loyalty to tribe fundamentally to establish a nation, right? To go above tribe to nation. And that's, again, that's the mode we're in. More and more, we're not willing to put loyalty to nation first. More and more, we declare that we have a right to put loyalty to tribe first, whatever the heck, you know, your definition of tribe is, if it's political party or it's sex, you know, the female tribe, the male tribe, you know, whatever it is, right? You're declaring, you know, it's like with multicultural or identity politics notions, right? That you have a right to put loyalty to the mores of your tribe ahead of the nation. And that sets the end then, right? You have to surrender that. You can't put loyalty to the tribe first. You can't have a nation. See, you know, see Red Man. There should be an asterisk and a little footnote that says, see the history of the Red Man. Every time you think that, right?
Then eventually the nation turns into global.
Right, I mean, eventually it goes higher and higher. But, you know, if it can't get from tribe up to nation, it certainly can't get to global level. That's vainly hoping for the future of a global government when you can't even surrender tribe to nation. Now, plus, don't forget, there's a technicality, you know, that once you have a nation forming, they establish a concept about this. There's a word for people who are citizens of a nation, you know, or a territorial state, you know, the next two notches above tribe. There's a word for when a citizen of a nation or a territorial state puts tribe before nation or state. It's called sedition. And it can't be allowed. I mean, it's, you can't, a nation or a state cannot allow that. That's why they have that strong word they call sedition about that. I mean, it's, if you allow that, that's the end of the nation. You just go back to a bunch of tribes again. And tribes do only one thing, war. I mean, think of the irony of those who are so against war and are such advocates for tribe. I mean, that's schizophrenic. Tribe implies war. Right? That's what one of the indispensables that gets you from tribe up to nation. Tribes finally get so darn tired of war, because that's what they are. It's just a warring fact. It can't be anything else when you're a tribe. It's so ridiculous what we're doing.
Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, from where the sun now stands, I shall fight no more forever.
Right. There were those individuals amongst the Redmen. They're trying so hard to get them to go up to nation, but they just couldn't do it. Right? Couldn't get enough of them. Yeah, so their civilization, you know, faded. Our civilization is fading. That's why this book is in my lap, right? Because we're going back to tribe. It's like, I have a right to put my tribe first. No, you do not. Literally codified in law, you don't. In a territorial state, that's called sedition. Technically, you should be executed for it, right? Wow. If you want to be harsh about it, right? We always used to, right? But at the very least, we can't allow that. I mean, we have to recognize the mechanics of it. You destroy civilization. You can't put tribe first. No matter what that tribe is, no matter how much, how cool you think the mores of your tribe are, you can't put them before the nation. Wrong. Okay. Yep.
After crossing over to America from China, the northern red man never again came into contact with other world influences except the Eskimo until he was later discovered by the white man. It was most unfortunate that the red man almost completely missed his opportunity of being upstepped by the admixture of the later Adamic stock. As it was, the red man could not rule the white man, and he would not willingly serve him. In such a circumstance, if the two races do not blend, one or the other is doomed.
Yeah, notice how that interesting little footnote they throw in there.
Lone Ranger and Tonto might have been an exception.
Yeah, I don't think I have to explain it too much what they're getting at there. And again, you think of the challenge that Adam and Eve have, you know, in blending the races. You have to try to challenge these individuals to actually be willing to put something above the race first. Right? You have to be willing to let go of the lower strains of culture and go up to a higher harmony culture. You know, and it's just all these insidious things. It's like, no, you can have a heterogeneous culture. No, you can't. That's illogical, right? Multiculturalism is insane. It's completely illogical. So we're just dooming ourselves by exalting those false notions. E pluribus unum. You have to go from many tribes up to one nation. Okay? And remember, ultimately, there is only one fact that can take you up from tribes. God. Right? There is only one thing that you can get everyone, no matter how different they are, male, female, you know, red, yellow, black, whatever. You can get all the differentials to reach up in common to and bring themselves together. God. God is the fact. The more secular a society becomes, the more the civilization's doomed. There's only one thing that can make out of many one. The one. God. One nation under God. It's the only way to have a nation.
But for now, we want a lot of nations.
Yeah.
To be distinct.
Right. I mean, we got to get above tribes. We got to get multiple nations. They need to be solid, integrous nations.
But is that different than multicultural?
Yes. Right. Multicultural is not across nations. It's within one nation.
Within one nation.
Yeah. See, which is dooming that nation. Right. You have solid, integrous nations, which each nation is above its tribal differentials. Right. And when you have an integrous nation that's ongoing, lasting, then you can have definitive, superadditive consequences of the relationship between nations. You can't have international if you don't have national. You know, think about how many people say, we should get rid of national and just have international. Think how illogical that is. International. You can't have international if you don't have national. And again, I mean, initially, to get from tribe to nation, there has to be an ism that's temporarily good. Nationalism gets you from tribe to nation. Once the nation is definitively integrous, okay, then you can take that to an extreme, it will become bad. You have to let go of that ism and stake a new ism, internationalism. Right? I mean, you use that ism thing to pull you along. But, you know, eventually, when you have it, you need to let go of it. But, you know, again, if you're starting to lose nation, there has to be some internationalism. There has to be some nationalism again, right, to solidify it. Right? Or you're going to have tribalism, right? You know, and tribalism is initially positive when all you have is clans. right, is a step forward to go to tribes, and you make it an ism. You make it a complete lifestyle solution. Initially, it is a complete lifestyle solution when you're going trying to go from clans to tribes. But then once you have tribes, okay, now it becomes negative. Now you need a higher ism. Yeah. So anyway, these basic facts are being lost, and we're wrecking ourselves on the rocks of our ignorance. Okay. Yeah, so we have time to do Orange Man here. Let me just make sure. Notice as well, it was most unfortunate. When they say that Red Man almost completely missed his opportunity. If you're just wondering, just reflect on what they've told you. When you have a favoritism of the sixth adjutant, you're in sort of that no man's land. Right, the stability of five adjutants, the stability of seven adjutants, and the inherent instability of six. Right, there aren't stable creatures anywhere in the universe that just have six adjutants. Right, that's not a stable system. And so, see, they were needing that booster shot. The Adamic uplift produces a greater engagement by the seventh adjutant into the humans. Just like the first six, six adjutants, the six Sangic races, the first six adjutants, right? The seventh race is the seventh adjutant. They needed that more of that seventh adjutant to put a bridle, a governor, on the sixth, right? Because it's just, and so we need that very much right now. We have all of this spiritual energy now. We need to bring in the seventh adjutant and put a governor on that, right? So it doesn't just race us off the cliff. Right, so that's what they're pointing out. It's exceptionally problematic. Yeah, they have all seven adjutants, but in many ways they're kind of just trying to do it with six. See, because of that favoritism of the sixth. It's just like when you get up and you first discover your religious impulse and you go, oh, that's all I need. This is a complete lifestyle solution. Now you need to keep going up, right? You need to find that philosophic impulse above that, because you need to be able to get above that and put a bridle on that sixth adjutant. It's a very important energy, but it needs to be very properly guided or it's going to carry you off where you don't want to go. Yep.
I can't help but think they're saying most unfortunate, not just for the red race, but for the human race.
Yeah, obviously, as they brought in at the end there. Think about how important a race this is on every world, and to kind of not have much of it blended in. As I mentioned, it's unfortunate that, as they mentioned in passing a little bit, and they'll mention it some more, before Red Man got himself isolated and kind of in this self-destructive mode in the Americas, he left behind some of his genetic nature, which is important.
Because I can't help but think that because they have a natural affinity for the sixth adjective, in a properly blended whole, it would be stable, unstable like it was when.
Man. The red man in the blended race on a normal world is really, that's the source of the religious, beginning of all the peoples on that planet. That's the spark within them, the red man within them, for their, religious beginning. But if it's not done kind of just quote unquote naturally like that, well, you've got to choose it more, right? If you don't have a lot of relationship to your sixth adjutant, you need to work on developing that. Okay, all right, let's see if we can get Orange Man in here before we wrap up.
To the Orange Man. The outstanding characteristic of this race was their peculiar urge to build anything and everything, even to the piling up of vast mounds of stone just to see which tribe could build the largest mound. Though they were not a progressive people, they profited much from the schools of the prince and sent delegates there for instruction.
You can see that. Obviously, the secondary sanghics are not going to be spear points in general. They're very important foundational elements, and on a world with all six, you're wanting to activate the potentials of those foundational elements more than on a world with just three. You know, by literally getting them separate, so that you have a more definitive differential and super additive consequence. But they're going to need lots of help from the prince's staff while they're still a separate race, those secondary sanghics.
Which adjunct would this be?
This is the third. Okay.
Courage.
What we've called spirit of courage or an energy of loyalty. The key thing that like I said, we don't want to go into all these, but just the thing about this third adjutant is that it gives you this first initial sense of transcendence of self, because it's the first measure of a unity conscious adjutant relative to the first two. It gives you a little bit, remember how they mentioned, it gives you a rudimentary, primitive kind of quasi-self-consciousness. That little bit of being above and apart from just your lowly flesh individuality, by having that little bit of contrast with the third adjutant in your mind. So when they favor that, they pick up on that transcendence thing, and that's why they're trying to pile rocks up to transcend the lowliness of the plane. They really feel that idea of transcendence deeply from the third adjutant. So it feeds into the way they rationalize everything.
Is the building, like, there's a ton in Europe of building that took place and here. Did it have anything to do with them?
No, not. If you're talking about megalithic stuff.
Well, just building in general.
This is all in a very primitive mode that doesn't have that complexity of building that the Andite mind, what else is
the Orange Race was the first to follow the coastline southward toward Africa as the Mediterranean Sea withdrew to the west, but they never secured a favorable footing in Africa and were wiped out of existence by the later arriving Green Race.
So just the geographic thing, they'll get into this a little bit more later on, but remember when you're in that area where these sanghics began, they couldn't move very much. And for a long time, until the ice receded and the geography changed some, they were just kind of stuck there. But eventually the Mediterranean actually starts to, draw back to the west. It's connected to the Indian Ocean at this time. And so there's no way to migrate over to, couldn't get to Africa. But eventually, when there's land there, they can head over to Africa. So that's what they're talking about there.
They didn't have boats.
Yeah, no one was doing, they mentioned later on that the first to get into that was the Andonites that became the Eskimos. They were the first ones to migrate via the sea. Before that, everyone is, doesn't have the imagination to think about that mode yet. And they're all just looking for a place to walk. They don't have horses or anything. They're just walking. So eventually, obviously, when we get to the green, we'll get that part of the story they mentioned about the green men following up behind them into Africa. Okay, keep going.
Before the end came, this people lost much cultural and spiritual ground. But there was a great revival of higher living as a result of the wise leadership of Porchunta, the mastermind of this unfortunate race, who ministered to them when their headquarters was at Armageddon some 300,000 years ago.
Yeah, so way back, before the rebellion, you had the mastermind of the Orange Race. And fascinating, see the location. Because again, that whole bit about, the name Armageddon right? It's, you know, basically the Mount of Megiddo. See, again, that mountain, mound, you know, high point. See, that they're tied to that. But very fascinating how that ends up, you know, in the book of Revelation, getting exalted into what we think when we say, when we hear Armageddon now. And to have them mention that there's a focus there that goes all the way back to Porshunta. It's a very fascinating little tidbit for them to throw in. Again, just notice that even though they are Homo sapiens, and so you have that greater wise nature, they keep stressing, but you need a booster shot individual, right? The wise leadership. Because you don't have the upstep yet. You don't have that upstepping of relationship to the seventh adjutant that the Adamic uplift gives you. So they're wise enough to be called Homo sapiens, but in very much need of someone that's exceptional in terms of wisdom potential. So all these leaders, and that's the fundamental thing about a leader. A leader is someone who has some big picture perspective, right? Can really function in a more holistic mode with wisdom, insight, and foresight. Have a relationship to truth. The fifth epical revelation is trying to find those individuals that can be those leaders. There's lots of people in general that need the third and fourth epical revelations and some of those initial priming of the pump. But the fifth is here about this wise leadership issue. It is a philosophic text to foster that holistic recognition, to not, you know, to transcend. A leader has to transcend the tribal differentials. Right? It has to transcend all the dichotomies. Right? You know, you're not looking for a leader who's the best example of a certain tribe and let's just force him up into, you know, you're looking for someone who is above the tribes for the leader. Someone who's wise, someone who transcends that circumscribed consciousness of the different tribes. And he's going to have to be strong leader because, you know, everyone is, all the tribal-minded people are going to be thinking, well, he's not of my tribe. Well, he's not of my tribe either. You're like, I think we all hate him because he's, you know, he's going to have to be strong because he has to stake a claim above the tribes, he or she. Now, where it is, strong person has to stake a claim above the tribes. And initially, you know, he's going to be at odds with all the tribes. Because the tribes have their mores, and they're very content with their mores, and they want to stay in those mores, and they think those mores are divine. And courageous and independent cosmic thinking. See, that's again why the courageous part is there. It takes a lot of courage to stand forth as a leader above the tribes. I mean, because they won't initially see that person as above. They'll see them, you know, they think horizontally. And it's like, he is completely other. It's just, you know, you'll see him as this island universe off to the side somewhere and doesn't seem to fit in anywhere and is going to be rejected by everyone. So it takes a lot of courage to stand up above all those and get people to turn their eyes up. Right? You know, it can't be horizontal in that tribal mode. Got to turn your eyes up. Right? It's a faith grasp. It's an upward grasp. Right? That leader has to encourage everyone to be an uppist, not a leftist or a rightist or a whateverist in the plane, right? But to turn their eyes up and be an uppist.
That's why Jesus would go after the truth in a religion that eventually would blot out the...
Right. I mean, if Jesus was here, you know, and his job was to try to foster an improvement in all the religions, what would he do? He'd take each religion and he'd try to get them to turn their eyes up. Right? Their eyes are horizontal. Right? You know, and we have these magical beliefs that you can take all those horizontal facts and just glue them together, put all their symbols horizontally side by side, and ta-da! No, you've got to transcend all those symbols, all those horizontal facts. Right? You got to get every religion to be an upist. And they don't want to be an upist. They're very content with their little ideological space. Right? They will... There will be much wailing and gnashing of teeth as you try to, yes, to get them to go up and let go, right? To be willing to, like, erase all their interpretations, like I said. Because those are boat anchors. All those interpretations are boat anchors. They're holding you down the plane. Until you can erase them, you can't go up. Spirit gravity can't lift those material things up, right? You've got to let go of them. You've got to let go of those individual interpretations. Allow yourself to be drawn up. It's not something that your animal origin nature is going to want to do. All right, let's see. So anything else there before we finish the last little paragraph here? Before the end came. There's all these very ominous statements here.
What's the coinage
name? Yeah, I don't know. Again, obviously, these are, you know, names and they're languages, okay. Right? I mean, you know, you're getting a flavor of red man tongue when you say Anamanalantang. You're getting a flavor of orange man tongue. You know, we don't have any orange man tongue on the planet, really, you know, probably anymore, with a name like Porshunta. I was just going to say, I mean, and again, you have to, you've got to deal with words like unfortunate. You know, and they're not doomed by God, but you know, you notice how they were speaking about the primary Sangic red man in the same way they are about the orange man. It's not a primary secondary bias, right? You're not racist like that or something. Bottom line, all of the Sangics are unfortunate unto themselves. There are six different parts. None of them are a whole. The whole point is to blend the parts together into a whole. Right? You want an equal relationship to all six adjutants. You don't want a favoritism for any of them. Right? And the only way is to have the seventh adjutant encourage all those adjutants to be an upist. Right? To orient those other six adjutants upward and not make them a horizontal end in themselves. All right, one little more tidbit here.
The last great struggle between the orange and the green men occurred in the region of the Lower Nile Valley in Egypt. This long, drawn-out battle was waged for almost 100 years, and at its close, very few of the orange race were left alive. The shattered remnants of these people were absorbed by the green and by the later arriving indigo men. But as a race, the orange man ceased to exist about 100,000 years ago.
Okay, so quite a long ways back, see? And the one little thing we want to end with here is, is what they're pointing out in there, the shattered remnants of these people were absorbed, right, into the stocks in Africa. That's why if you take off your blinded eyes, and look objectively at the skin colors in Africa, you'll find that it isn't a continent of black people. It's a continent of many different colors of people. If some of those people are quite orange, right? You can, even though, right? I mean, but as a race, the orange man ceased to exist about 100,000 years ago. Even though that's the case, there are definitely groups of people, or occasionally individuals even, you know, if a little recessive orange comes out in an individual, you know, look at those stocks in Africa and notice, oh, wait a minute, this one is quite orange relative to the others. Yeah, isn't this individual? It's the same way with the indigo. Right, you can find individuals that don't have so much blending that their skin isn't still quite indigo, right? If you stop just saying, oh, it's a black person, it's like, no, look at them. They're not black, they're indigo, right? To get black, you've got to have kind of equal measures of orange, green, and indigo. And then there are some, you know, there's some ebony black people. Right? Those aren't indigo. Indigo people are indigo. Orange or orange, green or green. Yeah, so just, you know, if you're not afraid to open your color eyes, even though our culture is kind of demanding that we close our eyes like that, just note that there are those colors and they are there to be seen. Yeah, you can look at someone in Sudan and they're orange. Yeah. Another person in Sudan, oh, they're indigo.
Green.
Right? Or if you look really close, occasionally you can find a green, and that's really cool. Yeah, and we'll talk about that when we get to Green Man. But they're there. They're definitely there to be noticed if you look. All right. So we'll sally forth as fast as we normally go. Next time on the other Sangha Grazes here. Yes, it's always in quotes when we say we will saunter forth. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.